You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 17th. I'm Alexis Withrow from Drake University. Here is our first story. Today's first article is Tie Vote Dead Ends Funding, PACE Request Killed by 2-2 Council Vote by David Golbitz. The article reads, the Council Bluffs City Council voted down a resolution this week that would have provided $150,000 over 3 years to Potawatomi Arts, Culture, and Entertainment starting in 2023. The resolution failed with a tie vote of 2-2 with one council member absent. Council members Chris Peterson and Joe DiSalvo voted in favor of the resolution, and Steve Gorman and Roger Sandow voted against. Councilman Chad Hannon was not present. By Iowa state code, if a resolution doesn't receive a majority of votes, it is considered defeated. The resolution would have basically been a continuation of an agreement made 5 years ago between the city council and PACE, when the nonprofit was looking for funding for what would become the Hoff Family Arts and Culture Center. The City Council Bluffs agreed to donate $250,000 over 5 years to help secure matching funds for a state grant. The council voted to authorize the final $50,000 payment during the October 24th meeting, satisfying the initial agreement. At the same meeting, several council members expressed concern for what the new $150,000 request would be funding. When PACE CEO Dana Keem first petitioned the city council for the funds of the October 10th study session, she said that the funds would go towards general operating expenses. Quite frankly, it costs a lot to run that big old 95-square-foot building, so that will help cover overhead, which is more like staff and bills to run the building, Keem said on October 10th. We have a lot of funders that like to support programming. What's important, though, for us to be able to show to some of our bigger donors, especially some of the bigger foundations, they want general operating support because those are the harder dollars to find. At the October 24th study session, many council members expressed concern for the precedent they would be setting by using taxpayer money for a nonprofit's operating expenses. I really have concerns with mixing into the operation fees of a private nonprofit, Gorman said. There's a lot of nonprofits in the community that will be here asking, knocking on the door of what we can do for them. Peterson agreed, saying, general operating is one of those big red flags because we'd go down a slippery slope. There's a lot of people that we're not funding that want general operating dollars. Peterson said that he would like to see PACE do more community outreach outside of the Hoffman Center, as well as specific metrics for what the city's dollars would be paying for. Sandu suggested that investing $50,000 is like going into business together, and requested that PACE provided additional financial information and, aside from general operating expenses, a list of what the money would be used for. I think we need to have very specific measurables, Sandow said. I think as a steward of the money, I think it has to be very dialed into what we are funding with taxpayer dollars. Ultimately, the council decided to push a decision about the new $150,000 request to November 14th due. The question is what the new funding would be paying for. During the November 14th meeting, came reiterated some of the metrics she had provided at the October 10th study session about PACE's financial impact out to the community. According to Kame, PACE provided more than 200 performances, classes, and exhibits, including adult learning, summer camps, theater productions, and music in the park concerts in 2021. Provides 350 hours of free programming for the community, which costs about $220,000 per year, anticipates surpassing more than 60,000 visitors in 2022, with more than one-third coming from out of state, bringing needed tourism dollars to the area. PACE will soon be taking possession of a Grant Wood painting. the early days of Canesville, which is owned by the city and has been hanging at the Iowa Western Community College. The painting, valued at $2 million, will hang in the Hoff Center Grant Wood. To be a lack of specific programming that the city's money would be funding. All parties seem to agree that the funds wouldn't go toward Pace's general operating budget, but without specifics, neither Gorman nor Sandeau could support the resolution. DeSalvo had made a motion to include more specific information in the resolution. Take the next 2 weeks to work with Pace to determine what those metrics would be and bring the resolution back for a vote at the next week meeting. That motion also failed by a vote of 2-2. In the article, there's a photo of the Hoff Family Arts and Culture Center with the caption, "Members of the public, check out the Hoff Family and Arts and Culture Center during a community open house on Saturday 29th, 2020. And that concludes that article. The next article's title is Education Reform Coming to Legislature. Iowa House Republicans Add Education Reform Committee in Next Session by Caleb Magolo. It reads, Iowa House Republicans will create a new Education Reform Committee for the upcoming legislative session. As Governor Kim Reynolds continues to push to direct millions in taxpayer dollars to private school tuition assistance. Increasing their majority in the House after last week's midterm election, Republicans will again hold the policy-making levers next year, and Republicans chairing the 21 committees will have discretion over which bills will be taken up in the committees before ultimately coming to a floor vote. This group of hardworking legislators is ready to get to work for our constituents, Republican House Speaker Pat Grassley of New Hartford said in a press release announcing the committee chairs. Our caucus is strong because of our wide breadth of experience and backgrounds to help us tackle all the issues Iowans care most about. Grassley will chair the Education Reform Committee, which will be a five-member panel that will consider bills containing significant reforms to our education system, according to the release. In an emailed statement, Grassley did not say whether the committee would consider a bill dealing with private tuition assistance. In the 2022 legislative session, Reynolds pushed for a bill to shift $55 million in taxpayer dollars from public schools to private school tuition assistance, but the bill failed to get enough support among Republican House members to pass. During the primary election, Reynolds endorsed several challengers to incumbent Republicans who opposed the bill, but it's unclear whether there will be enough support to pass the measure next year. The House Republican Caucus plans to consider a broad set of education reforms this session, Grassley said in the statement. This new committee will allow these important issues to be put in front of the entire caucus for the in-depth discussions they deserve. Republicans also considered bills this year that would require schools to post course materials online for parents' review and prohibit obscene material from school libraries. Reynolds campaigned on reviving school choice efforts, and Parents Matter was a common campaign slogan. It is going to be an agenda where you keep more of your money, where our schools are thriving and all parents have a choice, Reynolds said of her agenda after being elected to a second full term on November 8th. Democratic House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst of Windsor Heights said in a statement that a majority of Iowans believe public money should remain in public schools. In a March Des Moines Register / MediaCon Iowa poll, 52% of Iowans opposed the proposal, while 41% favored it. Democrats have not announced who from their caucus will be on the committee. Iowans don't care if a new committee in the Iowa legislature is created to consider the governor's voucher plan or other bad ideas like jailing teachers and banning books because it's just all politics, Confer said. House Democrats stand alongside Iowans and will oppose any bill that shifts money from public schools to private schools. It's time to put people over politics. Republicans also added an International Relations Committee, which will be chaired by Representative Eddie Andrews, R. Johnson, and removed the Information Technology Committee. House Democrats have not yet announced who will serve as ranking members on the committees. The full list of committee chairs is below. Administrative Rules Review, Representative Megan Jones, residing Sioux Rapids. Agriculture, Representative Mike Sexton, residing Rockwell City. Operations, Representative Gary Moore, residing Bettendorf. Commerce, Representative Shannon Ludgrig, residing Pistoa. Economic Growth, Representative Ray Soren, residing Greenfield. Education, Representative Skylar Wheeler, residing Hull. Education Reform, Representative Pat Grassley, residing New Hartford. Environmental Protection, Representative Dean Fisher, residing Montour. Ethics, Representative Ann Osmundson, residing Volga. Government Oversight, Representative Brooke Bowden, residing Indianola. Human Resources, Representative Ann Meyer, residing Fort Dodge. International Relations, Representative Eddie Andrews, residing Johnston. Judiciary, Representative Steve Holt, residing Denison. Labor, Representative Dave Doye, residing Nevada. Local Government, Representative Shannon Latham, residing Sheffield. Natural Resources, Representative Tom Gierney, residing Lamar's. Public Safety, Representative Phil Thompson, residing Jefferson. State Government, Representative Jane Bloomingdale, residing Northwood. Transportation, Representative Brian Best, residing Glidden. And Veteran Affairs, Representative Chad Ingalls, residing Randalia. That concludes the legislature. The next article, IWCC Opens Training Center, opens with a photo of three men and a few women in a circle having a meeting. The photo's caption reads, Matt Mancuso, Executive Director of Economic and Workforce Development at Iowa Western Community College, second from left, speaks alongside PowerTech President Josh Kalson, left, Mayor Matt Walsh, second from right, and New Visions Homeless Services Interim CEO Brady Waller, right, inside the school's new Business and Community Training Center, 2120 23rd Avenue, during a tour of the facility on Wednesday, November 16th, 2022. The new center will serve as a training facility for those doing apprenticeships through the college and employees from local businesses who need to upgrade their skills and don't have extra equipment for trainees to use during work hours. Starting in December, Iowa Western will also train selected New Visions Homeless Services guests in welding. Again, the title for this article is IWCC Opens Training Center with a subtitle, Site Will Serve Business Apprenticeships Homeless Population. This article is by Tim Johnson. It reads, Iowa Western Community College celebrated National Apprenticeship Week Wednesday by inviting stakeholders to tour its new IWCC Business and Community Training Council Center at 2120 23rd Avenue. Council Bluffs Mayor Matt Walsh read a mayoral proclamation about the week, which is observed from November 14th to the 20th this year, the 85th anniversary of the National Apprenticeship Act. It's also the eighth time the event has been held to raise awareness of the vital role registered apprenticeships provide in creating opportunities by allowing apprentices to earn while they learn, and preparing a pathway to good quality jobs and well-paying careers, the proclamation stated in part. The new center will serve as a training facility for those doing apprenticeships through the college and employees from local businesses who need to upgrade their skills and don't have extra equipment for trainees to use during work hours. Iowa Western has welding, robotics, electrical, and other labs in Caney Hall, but they are being fully utilized, according to Starlin Perdue, Director of Economic Development at the college. This will give us an opportunity to train with more businesses and partner with PowerTech, she said. The first phase is going to be training technicians that already have a skill set and providing certification to work on Kohler equipment, said Josh Kalson, president of PowerTech LLC at 2614 Railroad Highway. Long term, he would like high school students and newer employees to train there to become certified, he said. Kohler will send instructors to teach employees to work on generators using the company's curriculum, Callison said. The company has donated some generators to use in training. The goal is that Iowa Western gets individuals prepared to teach the curriculum, he said. PowerTech offers apprenticeships in residential and commercial electrician work, Callison said. We have somewhere around 40 or 50 apprentices right now, mostly in Council Bluffs and Omaha, he said. Starting in December, Iowa Western will train selected New Visions Homeless Services guests in welding, Purdue said. They will be tested after training to determine their skill level. Those who are ready will also receive instruction in job-seeking skills. Instruction will be covered by Iowa's GAP Tuition Assistance Program, and students will not have to have their own tools and equipment. Everybody needs purpose, and some of these men have lost their purpose, said Brandy Waller, interim CEO of New Visions. Part of our mission is to provide opportunity. We don't want anybody to experience homelessness in our community, and if they do, we want it to be short. A lot of these guys have done welding but have never had the training. This year, we've really looked at our training, said Matt Mancuso, Executive Director of Economic and Workforce Development at Iowa Western. We hired Alexis Johnson to be our apprenticeship coordinator, and the facility will be used for apprenticeships, among other training. It's really fun to see this building happen, Callison said. Apprentices are core to us being able to operate as a business. The workforce is aging, and we've got to have young people ready to fill those vacancies. And that concludes that article. The next article is two Omahans sentenced for sex trafficking of minors, by Molly Ashford. The article reads, an Omaha man has been sentenced in federal court to life in prison for his role in a sex trafficking conspiracy involving at least three minors in the Omaha and Council Bluffs area. Carney Turner, 42, was sentenced this week to life on one count of conspiracy to sex trafficking minors, three counts of sex trafficking a minor, and two counts of child enhancement. Co-defendant Julissa Briggs, a 20-year-old Omahan who pled guilty to conspiracy but also was being trafficked by Turner, was sentenced to 7 years and 3 months in prison. A third co-defendant, Sydney Marker, will be sentenced Monday on a conspiracy charge. All three defendants pled guilty. Turner first landed on law enforcement's radar in September 2020 during the investigation of a separate trafficking case. A search warrant for Facebook messages from a minor female revealed that Turner was communicating with her to set up plays at hotels around Omaha and Council Bluffs. When questioned, the girl identified Turner as her trafficker and said he had kept the money she made. In October, a 17-year-old girl came forward to law enforcement. She had been referred to Turner by a friend, and she reached out to him for help when she was kicked out of her home. According to an affidavit, Turner took her shopping before promising her $200 if she would talk to a man with him at a Council Bluffs motel. Instead, Turner made her enter the hotel room alone, where she was raped. In November, another minor was reported missing by her foster parents. While monitoring websites used for commercial sex, law enforcement officers found at least 16 ads with photos of the missing girl. The phone number listed on the ads was linked to an account created by Turner. Marker rented an apartment in Ralston that she shared with Biggs and Turner. They allowed at least one of the minors to live with them there and often arranged for commercial sex acts to take place. In her plea agreement, Marker wrote, "I deliberately closed my eyes and took actions to avoid knowing that Carney Turner was sex trafficking minors. I also did things which helped him sex traffic minors. I am very sorry." Homeland Security assisted the Omaha Police Department in investigating the case. That is the end of this article. Our next article that I will be reading is Ernst Elected Republican Policy Committee Chair by Caleb McCullough. The article reads, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, representing Iowa, was elected chair of the Senate Republican Policy Committee on Wednesday, taking the number 4 spot in GOP Senate leadership. Since 2018, Ernst has been at the number 5 spot, the vice chair of the Senate Republican Conference. "I will be working with all of the members in our conference in presenting different ideas and entailing collaboration," Ernst said in a press conference Wednesday. "We heard a lot about that over the past several days, so we want to make sure that all of our voices are heard and their ideas are presented fairly across our conference." The Senate Republican Policy Committee provides a forum for Republicans to discuss policy among their caucus, including a weekly policy lunch, according to committee's webpage. It also advances Republican policies by providing positions on legislation, floor debate, and votes. The committee is currently chaired by U.S. Senator Roy Blunt, residing Missouri, who will be retiring at the end of the year. Senator Shelley Moore Capito, residing West Virginia, will replace Ernst as vice chair of the Senate Republican Conference. "I'm excited about the opportunity to work with each one of our members as we move, of course, into the next election cycle, and I know that the American people will hear our message and it will resonate with them," Ernst said. And that concludes that article. Our next article is Weather, Flying South for the Winter. It opens with two images, one pictured geese and the other with seagulls. Under the picture of the geese, it says, "Canada geese gather along the water's edge at Lake Manawa State Park on Wednesday, November 16th, 2022. There's a chance of flurries before noon today with a high expected around 32, according to the National Weather Service. The next picture with the seagulls has a caption, "Ring-billed gulls gather along frozen over water at Lake Manawa State Park on Wednesday, November 16th, 2022. The regional outlook for the weather is partly sunny, becoming windier and cold today. Expect less than 2 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity 65 and fair drying conditions. Turning out clear tonight. Average relative humidity 70%, mostly sunny tomorrow. Coldest air so far this season. It will feel like mid-January, so dress warmly." The national outlook is an extended significant lake effect snowstorm will get underway through the Great Lakes today, leading to bands of very heavy snow at times and lighter showers of rain and snow for much of the interior northeast. Snow will also fall through parts of the Rockies, potentially extending into parts of the Central Plains. For the regional forecasts, it is starting with Ames, a high of 32, low of 15. For Atlantic, is a high of 31, low of 11. For Avoca, it is a high of 31, low of 11. For Beatrice, it is high of 35, low of 11. For Cedar Falls, it is a high of 31, low of 16. Cedar Rapids is a high of 30, low of 14. For Clarinda, it is a high of 34, low of 13. For Columbus, it is a high of 30, low of 9. For Council Bluffs, it is a high of 32, low of 11. For Davenport, it is a high of 33, low of 18. For Denison, it is a high of 28, low of 10. For Des Moines, it is a high of 32, low of 14. For Duquesne, it is a high of 29, low of 16. For Fort Madison, it is a high of 33, low of 17. For Glenwood, it is a high of 32, low of 13. For Harlan, it is a high of 29, low of 10. For Iowa City, it is 33 with a low of 18. For Kansas City, it is a high of 41, low of 15. For Lincoln, it is a high of 35, low of 11. For Mason City, it is a high of 27, low of 13. Missouri Valley, high of 29, low of 11. Muscatine is a high of 34, low of 18. Nebraska City is a high of 35, low of 14. Norfolk, high of 28, low of 9. Okoboji is a high of 27, low of 12. Omaha will be a high of 33, low of 12. Ottawa is a high of 32, low of 15. Red Oak will be a high of 33, low of 13. St. Joseph, high of 38, low of 13. Shenandoah, high of 34, low of 13. Sydney, high of 34, low of 13. Sauk City, high of 27, low of 10. Walnut, high of 31, low of 11. Waterloo, high of 30, low of 16, and Woodbine with a high of 29, low of 11. Again, you're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Non-Perial for November 17th, 2022 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Alexis Withrow from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. We will now be moving on to obituaries of Herbert G. Herb Sudman. Herbert G. Herb Sudman, age 96, passed away November 16, 2022. He was born October 26, 1926. The late Fritz and Mary Dears Sudman in Traer, Iowa. Herb graduated from Traynor High School with the class of 1944. He was a lifelong farmer and a member of St. Paul Lutheran Church. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by his wife, Mary Ann Sudman, daughter Cindy Stewart, son-in-law Greg Stewart, sister Selma Anderson. Herb is survived by his children, Craig Sudman Donna, Gail Mark Leber, and Terry Gierton Dave, brother Freddie Sudman Connie, grandchildren and great-grandchildren, nieces, nephews, and cousins. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. at Hoy Kolnowski Funeral Home on Friday, November 18, 2022. Funeral service is at 10 a.m. at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Traynor on Saturday, November 19, 2022. Interment is in the St. Paul Lutheran Church Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to St. Paul Lutheran Church or Traynor Fire and Rescue. The chosen florist is from Hy-Vee, their floral shop, on 2323 West Broadway. That concludes our obituaries. We will now be moving on to our next article entitled "Overdose Deaths May Be Peaking, But Experts Worry" by Mike Stobie. The article reads, New York. Have U.S. drug overdose deaths stopped rising? Preliminary government data suggests that they may have, but many experts are urging caution, noting that past plateaus didn't last. U.S. overdose deaths rates began steadily climbing in the 1990s, driven by opioid painkillers, followed by waves of deaths led by other opioids like heroin and most recently, illicit fentanyl. Last year, more than 107,000 Americans died of drug overdoses, the highest tally in U.S. history. On Wednesday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released provisional data on what happened through the first 6 months of the year. The news appears to be hopeful. Provisional data indicates U.S. overdose deaths fell 3 months in a row. The CDC estimated there were about 107,600 overdose deaths for the 12-month period between July 2021 and June 2022. That's 40 fewer than the 2021 calendar year. Today's data continue to show a hopeful trend of a decrease in overdose deaths, but more prevention and treatment work is needed. Dr. Rahul Gupta, director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, said in a statement Wednesday. Indeed, the decline is uneven. Only 8 states reported fewer overdose deaths, while all the others showed continued increases. And only 4 states, Maryland, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia, reported sizable overdose deaths and decrease of 100 or more, compared with the previous July to June period. Those few states which have had some of the nation's the highest overdose death rates appear to be at the root of the national improvement this year, said Brandon Marshall, a Brown University public health researcher who tracks overdose trends. Officials in the 4 states said there was no single explanation, but they believe recent efforts may be paying off. They cite social media and health education campaigns to warn the public about the dangers of drug use, expanded addiction treatment, and wider distribution of the overdose-reversing medication naloxone. I'm so proud of everything going on in this state, said Robin Rickard, executive director of Maryland's Opioid Operational Command Center. She singled out naloxone access, saying, I think that has had a huge, huge impact on our fatality numbers, quite frankly. Rickard and other state and federal officials are not declaring victory, however. Gupta called for more federal funding to bolster prevention and treatment. Some researchers are doubtful overdoses have peaked. Instead, they think a spike occurred during the COVID-19 pandemic when lockdowns and other restrictions isolated those with drug addictions and made treatment harder to get. We may just be returning to pre-COVID level. I think we'll need at least a year more of data to confirm that, said Aaron Winsley, a West Virginia University researcher focused on the overdose epidemic's health effects. The numbers are not close to pre-pandemic levels yet. Nationally, the July 2021 to June 2022 estimated number of deaths is still more than 5% higher than the number in July 2020 to June 2021 and 28% higher than the July 2019 to June 2020. Deaths from illicit drugs are not only a public health crisis but also a political issue. About 3/4 of voters in the midterm elections this month said they were concerned about the use of opioids in their community, including about 1/3 who are very concerned, according to AP VoteCast, a survey of more than 94,000 midterm voters nationwide. Researchers have seen false plateaus before. Overdose deaths seem to be leveling off for a couple of months in the spring of 2021 before rising again. There may also be lessons from 2018. That year, there were about 60 7,000 U.S. drug overdose deaths, a 4% drop from 2017. The numbers were celebrated, with President Donald Trump declaring, "We are curbing the opioid epidemic." Officials attributed the improvement to tougher policing, treatment program expansions, policies to limit opioid painkiller prescriptions, and wider distribution of naloxone. But some University of Pittsburgh researchers later concluded the improvement was largely the result of a 2017 change in China's regulation of the powerful opioid carfentanil. That change cut U.S. supplies of the drug and was followed by dramatic declines in overdose deaths in a handful of states. Researchers who doubted that 2018 heralded the start of an enduring decline turned out to be right. The numbers rose in 2019 and then soared when the COVID-19 pandemic hit. And that concludes that article. Our next article is U.S. House Eyes Prospect of Seating Cherokee Nation Delegate by Sean Murphy. It reads, "The Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma moved a step closer to having a promise fulfilled from nearly 200 years ago that a delegate from the tribe be seated in Congress." Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin was among those who testified Wednesday before the U.S. House Rules Committee, which is the first to examine the prospect of seating a Cherokee delegate in the U.S. House. Hoskin, the elected leader of the 440,000-member tribe, put the effort in motion in 2019 when he nominated Kimberly Teehee, a former advisor to President Barack Obama, to the position. The tribe's governing council then unanimously approved her. The tribe's right to delegate is detailed in the Treaty of New Echoka, signed in 1835, which provided the legal basis of the forced removal of the Cherokee Nation from its ancestral homelands east of the Mississippi River and led to the Trail of Tears, but it has never been exercised. A separate treaty in 1866 affirmed this right, Hoskin said. "The Cherokee Nation has in fact adhered to our obligations under these treaties," Hoskin told the panel. "I am here to ask the United States to do the same." Hoskin suggested to the committee that Teehee could be seated as early as this year by way of either a resolution or change in statute, and the committee's chairman, Massachusetts Democrat Representative James McGovern, and other members supported the idea that it could be accomplished quickly. "This can and should be done as quickly as possible," McGovern said. "The history of this country is a history of broken promise after broken promise to Native American communities. This cannot be another broken promise." But McGovern and other committee members, including ranking member Representative Tom Cole of Oklahoma, a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation, acknowledged there are some questions that need to be resolved, including whether other Native American tribes are afforded similar rights and whether the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma is the proper successor to the tribe that entered into the treaty with the U.S. government. McGovern said he has been contacted by officials with the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma and the Delaware Nation, both of which have separate treaties with the U.S. government that call for some form of representation in Congress. McGovern also noted there are two other federally recognized bands of Cherokee Indians that argue they should be considered successors to the 1835 treaty, the United Kiowa Band of Cherokee Indians in Oklahoma and the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians based in North Carolina, both of which reached out to his office. The UKB selected its own congressional delegate, Oklahoma Attorney Victoria Holland, in 2021. Holland said in an interview with the Associated Press that her tribe is a successor to the Cherokee Nation that signed the 1835 treaty, just like the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. As such, we have equal rights under all the treaties with the Cherokee people, and we should be treated as siblings, Holland said. Only a few Native Americans serve in Congress, including Cole and the U.S. Representative Mark Wayne Mullen, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation who was elected earlier this month to the U.S. Senate, where he will become the first Native American in the body in nearly 20 years. As a member of the Cherokee Nation, I firmly believe the federal government must honor its trust and treaty responsibilities to Indian nations, Mullen said in a statement. We are only as good as our word. Members of the committee seemed to be in agreement that any delegate from the Cherokee Nation would be similar to five other delegates from the District of Columbia, Guam, the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, American Samoa, and the Virgin Islands. These delegates are assigned to committees and can submit amendments to bills, but cannot vote on the floor for final passage of bills. Puerto Rico is represented by a non-voting resident commissioner elected every 4 years. And that concludes that article. Our next reading is Biden Facing Pressure to Extend Student Loan Payment Pause by Colin Binkley and Chris McGuirin. It reads, in the days and weeks before the midterm election, President Joe Biden trumpeted his plan to cancel billions in student loans as he rallied young people to support Democrats. But now the initiative is in jeopardy because of legal challenges. The debacle is swiftly becoming a headache for the administration instead of an example of how the president keeps his promises to voters. The White House insists it will prevail even though two federal courts blocked the program from taking effect. However, the setbacks have rattled supporters who fear that more than 40 million Americans who expected relief will instead start getting billed for their student debt in January, when moratorium on payments is slated to expire. You cannot ask people to begin repaying on a debt that shouldn't exist, said Melissa Birney, an advocate for loan cancellation. We bear no blame in this broken system. The impasse has left the White House in a bind over whether to extend the moratorium of the legal battle drags on, even though Biden has said the COVID-19 pandemic, the original reason for the pause in payments, is over. The freeze already cost the federal government more than $100 billion in lost revenue, according to the Government Accountability Office. Critics such as the Committee for the Responsible Federal Budget are warning that another extension could worsen inflation and rise the risk of economic recession. Republicans oppose cancellation as an unfair handout for the wealthy, arguing Americans who didn't go to college will bear the cost as well. Conservatives orchestrated a barrage of legal attacks against Biden's plan, saying it overstepped the president's authority. In the meantime, borrowers across the nation yet again face uncertainty. An estimated 20 million were eligible to get their federal student loans canceled entirely by Biden's plan, which would cancel $10,000 in student loan debt for those making less than $125,000 or household making less than $250,000. Those who receive Pell Grants, typically given to those with lower incomes, would get another $10,000 in forgiveness. Now, it's unclear if borrowers will be expected to make payments on that debt when the pause ends and the political hazards are growing. At risk is support from 43 million borrowers who were promised at least some debt relief, including millions of younger Americans, a demographic that helped deliver key wins for Democrats in the midterm elections. Joshua Asset, who is eligible for $20,000 in cancellation, said it would be destabilizing if her payments restart in January. The 33-year-old Dallas attorney owes $163,000 in law school debt with monthly bills of up to $2,000. Asante voted for Biden but criticizes him for reaping in benefits of his plans in the midterms only to have borrowers left out in the cold. Honestly, there's a lot of frustration toward the Biden administration. I think that they anticipated that there would be legal challenges to the student loan cancellation, she said, calling the court challenges to be expected. Cedric Richmond, who worked in the White House before becoming a senior advisor to the Democratic National Committee, doubted that Biden will face political fallout if the program is ultimately blocked. If the program is blocked, he said, the blowback should go exactly where it deserves, and that's with this rogue Supreme Court. About 6 in 10 voters under 45 approve of Biden's handling of student loan debt, according to AP Votecast, a survey of more than 94,000 voters nationwide. Voters as a whole were almost eventually divided on this issue, while Democrats were far more likely to show approval than Republicans. Nearly 26 million people already applied for the debt relief out of an estimated 43 million eligible. The Education Department stopped accepting new applications Friday after a federal judge in Texas struck down on the plan. Speaking in New Mexico on November 3rd, Biden said he was on a solid legal ground. We're fighting them in court, he said. We're not letting them get away with it. Nearly half of borrowers surveyed by the Student Debt Crisis Center say they will be unable to afford student debt payments within 6 months, according to a report released Tuesday. Borrowers do not feel that the pandemic is over. They do not feel that the economic impacts are over, said Natalia Abrams, president of the center. We will need to pause payments until legal hurdles are cleared. Legality of mass student debt forgiveness was in question from the start. After being elected, Biden said it would be best if the measure came from Congress. Soon before leaving office, the Trump administration released a memo concluding that the White House does not have authority for wide cancellation. Supporters say they still have faith in Biden's plan will survive, despite predictions that it could go before a Supreme Court that has shifted to the right and curbed Biden's authority in other decisions. They argue the Higher Education Act gives the president wide power to cancel federal student debt. Some legal scholars say Biden should scrap the current plan and start over. And that concludes that article. Our next article is titled Strike Deemed a Fluke, with subheading Missile Hit in Poland Could Have Been Result of Air Defense System, by Vasilia Spedebako. It reads, NATO member Poland and the head of the military alliance both said Wednesday that a missile strike in Polish farmland that killed two people appeared to be unintentional and was probably launched by air defenses in neighboring Ukraine. Russia had been bombarding Ukraine at the time in an attack that savaged its power grid. Ukraine's defense was launching their missiles in various directions, and it is highly probable that one of these missiles unfortunately fell in Poland's territory, said Polish President Andrzej Duda. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, to suggest that it was an intentional attack on Poland. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, at a meeting of the 30-nation military alliance in Brussels, echoed the preliminary Polish findings. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, however, disputed them and asked for further investigation. The assessments of Tuesday's deadly missile landing appeared to dial back the likelihood of the strike, triggering another major escalation in the nearly nine-month-old Russian invasion of Ukraine. Still, Stoltenberg and others laid overall but not specific blame on Russian President Vladimir Putin's war. This is not Ukraine's fault. Russia bears ultimate responsibility, Stoltenberg said. Zelensky told reporters he had no doubts about a report he received from his top commanders that it wasn't our missile or our missile strike. Ukrainian officials should have access to the site and take part in the investigation, he added. Let's say openly, if, God forbid, some remnant of Ukraine's air defenses killed a person, these people, then we need to apologize, he said. But first, there needs to be a probe access. We want to get data that you have. Before the Polish and NATO assessments, U.S. President Joe Biden said it was unlikely that Russia fired the missile, but added, I'm going to make sure we find out exactly what happened. A Russian Defense Ministry spokesman in Moscow said no Russian strike Tuesday had closer than 22 miles from the Ukraine-Poland border. The Kremlin denounced Poland's and other countries' initial response and, in rare praise for a U.S. leader, hailed Biden's restrained, more professional reaction. We have witnessed another hysterical, frenzied, Russophobic reaction that was not based on any real data, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said. The Polish president said the missile was probably a Russian-made S-300 dating from the Soviet era. Ukraine, once part of the Soviet Union, fields Soviet and Russian-made weaponry. And that concludes this article. Next, we're moving on to sports with an article stating, we meet again, with a large photo of the Titans football team. The caption reads, Lewis Central takes the field before the state 4A football semifinal at the Uni Dome in Cedar Falls on Thursday. The article entitled We Meet Again has a subheading, Titans and Saints square up for the Class 4A championship for second straight year. This article is by Austin Heinen. It reads, from day one, Lewis Central coach Justin Camrad and the team's mindset has been to not defend the title, but to go win it again. This Thursday night, Lewis Central will have the opportunity for the second consecutive year against the Saints of Cedar Rapids Xavier. Having played each other in the title game last year, there is a bit of familiarity, but the Titans still expect plenty of differences in this meeting. As a program, our kids and coaches are extremely blessed to be in this position, Cameron said. Most kids don't get this opportunity, and we are one of the very fortunate ones who still get to play and go after a state championship. To reach this point is really a tribute to what they've been through this season, from our challenging non-district scheduling to handling our business in district play and beating two teams twice throughout the year, really tributes to their focus, discipline, and staying the course of taking things one game at a time. The Saints defeated Indianola 23-6 to earn their trip to Cedar Falls and then beat North Scott 38-10 to earn their place back in championship game. In doing so, the Saints' offense has kept their opponents off balance. With a senior quarterback who has thrown over 1,400 yards and a running back who has run over 1,400 yards, the Titans' defense must prepare for a balanced offensive attack that has proved challenging to stop this season. They put the defense on their heels, and that's the beauty of their offense, Cameron said. They are going to run the ball at you and power run at you, and they're going to run the play action to take shots downfield, and they set themselves up in a different formations to get you thinking. So for us defensively, it's going to be key that we understand the situations, the down and the distance, and understanding their formations so we can talk and communicate between all 11 guys to put ourselves in the right position. Just like last week, our guys are going to have to play gap sound, and we have got to get ready and know our assignments. Offensively, the Titans know the Saints are going to look to force some turnovers. The Saints forced three key turnovers in their semifinal win over North Scott, which turned into points each time. The Titans know they have to secure the ball against this opportunistic defense. Securing the football is one of our key points every single week, Kamran said. We always talk about turnovers and about maximizing our possessions while limiting our opponent's possessions. Xavier's defense has done a great job at forcing turnovers, which has allowed them to be successful and provide themselves with extra opportunities to score. We have to be really smart with our football and understand what they see from our defense. Regardless of the outcome, LC knows this will be its final performance of the season. While the players and coaches have enjoyed the ride, they now hope to put another exclamation mark on what's been another magnificent season. I'm grateful for this opportunity to coach these kids, Cameron said. It's been fun and it's been great to see them week in and week out go to battle, play at a top level, endure the ups and downs, and be resilient and tough. This has been a fun 14 weeks watching these guys playing, and we're looking forward to playing one more time. Lewis Central and Xavier Central Rapids will kick off at 7 p.m. on Thursday in the Uni Dome at Cedar Falls. Lewis Central will be going for its second state title, while Xavier will be targeting its fourth state title. And this concludes the sports section. And this brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 17th, 2022. The Nonpareil can be heard each day at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Alexis Withrow from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.